According to Chuck Swindoll, it's tempting for a group of believers or a congregation to become an exclusive club where only Christians attend. We speak our own language, applaud our achievements, and look into the mirror and admire everything we see. Today on Insight for Living, Chuck opens the New Testament to a scathing rebuff from a man named Jude. We'll be reminded that our self-indulgences can be the enemy's opportunity. Our demise won't happen all at once. Instead, Satan fetters away at our moral resolve in small, erosive increments. Chuck titled today's study, The Acts of the Apostates.
Apostates are people who willfully and deliberately defect from the faith. Although they once appeared to agree with the church on the doctrines of Christianity, truth be told, they never really trusted Christ for eternal salvation. In fact, with arrogance and defiance in their hearts, apostates purposefully oppose the orthodox central teachings of the Christian faith, and at the same time, they plant seeds of doubt, division, and dissension among believers. In our day and age, we see blatant rejection of the truth throughout our world, and we are constantly challenged with a number of questions like, how can we stand strong against those who would undermine our faith? And how can we keep our feet on the way of dependable truth in a world of deceptive fiction? Great questions, aren't they? The single chapter book of Jude speaks directly to those questions and to many others. Today we'll talk about our need to be equipped and to stand against false teaching by developing discernment between doctrinal truth and error. The first time it was read, that tiny, remarkable book of Jude probably fell like the blow of a hammer onto the hearts of its audience, condemning the acts of those who oppose the faith, as well as warning faithful believers. This small single-chapter letter may be the most dramatic exposé and denunciation of heresy in the entire Bible. It's a powerful letter. It calls us to prepare for battle. It also encourages us to equip our hearts and our minds with a knowledge, a deep knowledge of and commitment to the truth. For today's scripture reading, I want to read for you from two parts of the New Testament. The first reading will be from the letter of Jude itself, and the other from the small letter of 2 Thessalonians. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, just a single verse there. I'll read it last, verse 3. But first, let's go to Jude and listen as I read for you the first four verses from the New Living Translation. I'd hope to go through 16 verses today, but that's a bit of a reach. Can't do it. And so we'll go through the first four verses, and admittedly, even with that, we'll be a little pressed for time. But first, the book of Jude begins. This letter is from Jude, a slave of Jesus Christ and a brother of James. I'm writing to all who have been called by God the Father, who loves you and keeps you safe in the care of Jesus Christ. May God give you more and more mercy, peace, and love. Dear friends, I've been eagerly planning to write to you about the salvation we all share. But now I find that I must write about something else, urging you to defend the faith that God has entrusted once for all time to His holy people. I say this because some ungodly people have wormed their way into your churches, saying that God's marvelous grace allows us to live immoral lives. The condemnation of such people was recorded long ago, for they have denied our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. And then over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3, Don't be fooled by what they say, for that day will not come until there is a great rebellion against God, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the one who brings destruction.
You're listening to Insight for Living. To download the outline notes for today's message, go to insightworld.org. Chuck Swindoll titled his sermon, The Acts of the Apostates.
I'd like to stretch your imagination for the next few minutes this morning and have you imagine yourself as an expert in the field of Shakespeare. And if that doesn't stretch your imagination, probably nothing will. You're a drama critic, and you've been invited to come to a theater where one of the masterpieces of Shakespeare will be performed. But you don't know which one it is. So you've sat down as a drama critic, awaiting the curtains opening, not knowing what you're going to see. Someone from the stage cast asks you to step back behind the scenes and visit with a few of the actors and actresses. So you think this is your moment to discover what the play will be. As you walk back behind the closed curtains up on the stage, you notice that there is a castle with ramparts that look out over a wooded countryside. Well, you know right away that you're not going to be seeing Othello, for that set is in Venice. You also know you won't be seeing Julius Caesar, because that begins in a street scene in Rome. And even though there is a castle scene in Macbeth, you know it doesn't begin that way, but with a group of witches around their cauldron, remember? And you discount that. You look around, you see a couple of soldiers that carry the banner of Denmark. That's a hint. You see an actor that's dressed like a king and an actress like a queen and another fellow that's going to play the part of a ghost. It's Hamlet. And as you visit with them, you sit back down out in the theater and you know something that nobody else around you knows, even though nobody's told you. You've picked up the hints from the theater in which you're sitting. The Christian today is like that drama critic. We're sitting in a theater of God's apocalyptic events, but there's not yet been the curtains opening, announcing the coming of His Son. We're surrounded by people who stare with a blank look at us at the curtains opening, knowing nothing of what's coming. But we've been given some insight, some foreview, some preview of what's to come. We've learned some hints. We know that when the curtains open, there will not be an explosion called Armageddon. We know better than that. We also know that even though people around us expect a very quiet, placid, peaceful millennium to dawn, that that's not coming. We discover, rather, that apostasy is upon us, because that is the sign of our age. It's a subtle one, so subtle you'd miss it. We tend to forget that Jesus said, many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. Or that Paul wrote in his last days on earth, in the latter times some will fall away from the faith, and the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but will turn away their ears from the truth and will be turned unto fables. But you be alert. You see, our times are not going to be marked by explosions, but rather by erosion. The passage you looked at a few moments ago in 2 Thessalonians is a direct statement declaring that, but we forget it. We anticipate some great arrival of Jesus Christ, some marvelous removal, and the earth sort of moving into a great world program of peace. But as a matter of fact, the signs are upon us that such will not be the case. Paul says, let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come. What's the it? Well, the day of the Lord. It will not come, except first there is the apostasia. The word means departure, withdrawal, falling away. It's the idea of defecting from God-given truths and principles. The apostasia will come F-I-R-S-T. He makes it so obvious. But the apostasy is subtle, and so we miss it. It's subliminal. It occurs, and we're in it, and we don't even know we're in it. We have a couple in our church, the wife of whom is a native of Germany. In fact, her childhood in Nazi Germany. And she would tell you much better than I could in her own way, with her own broken English, that if you had lived in Nazi Germany as she lived with her family, you wouldn't have sensed it either. It just happened. And all of a sudden you realized that you were in a Holocaust. Just the erosion of those things that they held dear, but replaced with things that seemed so necessary. And suddenly you're under Nazi control. Now that's what the postcard of Jude is all about. As a matter of fact, I felt that if I could just get through half the letter, it would be great. And then I boiled it down to a third of the letter and thought that would be marvelous. And then I wound up with the first four verses, and like the Egyptian mummy, I'm pressed for time already this morning. I want you to look this morning at the first part of verse 1, which announces the writer. It's going to trouble you that he calls himself Judas. Because immediately you think of one person. You just can't think of some other Judas. But it's not Iscariot, of course. Judas Iscariot has long since taken his life. There was a disciple named Judas, not Iscariot. Wouldn't that be horrible to have lived in that day and had the name Judas? Like living in the 40s with the name Adolf, not Hitler, you tell everyone as you meet them. And so it is with Judas. But this was Judas, not Iscariot. This was, can you believe it? Judas, the son of Mary and Joseph. The half-brother of Jesus himself. The blood brother of James, who wrote the letter called James. This is Judas, who lived in the days in which Nero lost his reasoning and became a madman on the throne of the empire. Judas gave us the kind of hints needed for thinking Christians to be aware the time has come, namely apostasia, departure. Notice to whom he wrote, to those who are the called, the beloved, and the ones who are kept. Now that happens to be Christians of all generations. It's a general letter written generally to born-again people, specifically to first-century Christians and generally to all Christians of all eras. And I think it is a timely word because of our day of apostasy. What's the theme of the letter? Verse 3, "Beloved, while I was making every effort to write you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you appealing that you earnestly contend for the faith." It's the only time in all the Bible where a writer started out to write one thing and wound up writing something altogether different. Frank Robinson would understand because he wrote Who Moved the Stone? He set out to disprove the resurrection of Jesus. He sat down, gathered the facts together, and with a publisher in mind who longed to have that kind of book, he was going to discount with the hard set of facts the resurrection of Jesus. But he wound up declaring the resurrection. Listen to his preface. This is essentially a confession. The inner story of a man who originally set out to write one kind of book and found himself compelled by the sheer force of circumstances to write quite another. Somehow my perspective has shifted, not suddenly, as in a flash of insight or inspiration, but slowly, almost imperceptibly, by the very stubbornness of the facts themselves. That's an honest admission. How'd you like to be the publisher anticipating the manuscript of Morrison? I'll have it finished in just a few more weeks, folks, and you're anticipating a great, great apologetic attacking the resurrection, and you get this manuscript, and it's in defense of the faith. Morrison set out to write one kind of book, but by the sheer circumstances was changed to write one altogether different. That was Judas' experience. The only man in Scripture that had that experience. He set out to write a soteriological treatise. He's going to write about our great salvation, and who didn't want to read about that? But he wound up writing a dogmatic apologetic. And who wants to read that? That's why we don't read it. It makes us uncomfortable, for one thing. And frankly, it's a bewildering book from another point of view. Judas wanted to write just like I want to preach. I want to preach the things that are really fun and exciting and positive. God comes along and says, "Hey, Swindoll, change your plan. You write today and you preach about something that doesn't have a positive ring. It's an alarming ring. In fact, it's negative. They may not want to hear it, but it needs to be said." So I come today with God's message in a real sense, not my own. See the word contend earnestly, those words, contend earnestly? I'm intrigued by etymology on occasion. Here's an example. The original word is epiagonizomai. Doesn't that change your life? In the middle of the word is agone, agony. It's the only time in all the New Testament this word, epiagonizomai, is used. Only time. The beginning part of it is to intensify it. And the last part of it says to do that sort of thing, but in the middle is agony. And it means to strive, to fight, to struggle, to battle. That's the thought. And Jude says, "I set out to just sort of inform you like Romans of our great salvation." And God told me, "I don't want a second Romans. I want a Jude, just a postcard that'll set them back on their heels. Because Jude, there's a battle going on. It will intensify as time passes." Now, we won't even attempt to get halfway through this letter, but I want to talk about the first, especially the third and fourth verses of this card. Contending suggests aggressiveness. And Christians, I confess to you, the easiest thing in the world for us to do is to find a soft pillow in this society, settle back in a comfortable spot, and sort of do our thing, and hope that somehow a little bit of salt rolls off and creates an interest and an abiding sense of conviction in someone else. And hopefully somehow something will happen in our day. That's not God's plan. He says, contend earnestly for the faith. Moffat calls this book a fiery cross to rouse the churches. John Knox, the missile that was sent to Scotland to make Mary's life miserable, said this: "There is no room in Christianity for complacency." Now, the spirit of that 16th century Jesuit scholar is what's in Jude right here. Nothing new. It goes all the way back to the first century. He made her miserable because he contended for the faith that she kept trying to push aside. I want to explain this business of the faith because it's the heart of the message. I want to give you three things about it. First of all, when Jude says contend for the faith, he doesn't have in mind saving faith. He doesn't have in mind trusting faith. Are you with me? Saving faith is that moment when the sinner is born into God's family by grace through faith. It's not a book about that. Trusting faith is the kind of faith Paul writes of when he says we walk by faith and not by sight. Not that kind of faith. This faith is the body of Christian doctrine found in the Scriptures in content and practice. That's the faith. Now, if you miss the last part of that explanation, then you'll miss the whole message of application. Content and application. Do you know who said this? Theory without practice is sterile. Sounds like some biblical scholar said that. Lenin said it. Don't give me people that buy the philosophy of communism. Give me people that buy the philosophy who are willing to put it in the raw edge of life and live like that. That's what will alter the world. All he's done is stolen the message of Christianity. Jude is saying, as he writes of agonizing for the faith, he includes both content and application. As my friend Howard Hendricks says, not only orthodoxy, but orthopraxy. Not only belief, but behavior. Not only creed, but conduct. Disturbs me that we would be satisfied simply to learn about our faith with nothing accompanying, no strings attached. Just let me live like I please, but I'll learn all you want me to learn. Okay, first, that I wanted to say. Second, you will observe that the faith was once for all delivered to the saints. Now, this tells me that in skeletal form, the doctrines of Christianity are not up for grabs. There is not a whole pocket of new doctrines hidden away somewhere that we someday will find and add to the faith. No, this is once for all delivered. I thought of that this morning when I walked out in the front yard and I ran fast because I was in my pajamas and I wanted to get the paper to see who won the game last night. And so I ran out there and ran back and I had the paper under my arms and got inside and closed the door. And suddenly it dawned on me, you know, this paper is just like Jude, once for all delivered. And when I open up to see what it says, I can't reprint it. I can't change who won the SC game. I don't want to, but I couldn't change it if I did. I can't alter the facts of the headline. They're there. They have been delivered to my doorstep to be read. That's the scriptures. Now, I know it isn't intellectually stimulating to think that. In fact, they tell you commit intellectual suicide when you abide by that kind of theology. New thought isn't needed. New insights, certainly. New appropriation. But it's once for all delivered. You know, the third thing I get from this third verse is it's delivered to the saints, not the clergy. Hey, that's the message of the Reformation. You know what they had in the days before Luther got his act together? They had a chain Bible in a pulpit in a dead language of the clergy who were on occasion accompanied by the laity, and may you never forget what side you're on, to hear ex cathedra what they believed. That's not the faith delivered to the saints. That's the faith delivered to a few theologians. Now, if you press all the way back and you go to the seed plot of where a lot of that stuff is begun, then you've got to go back to the seminaries. Like it or not, in our day, you've got to go to the place where that kind of stuff is forged out. That's all the more reason to guard carefully the schools, where their head is. I remember hearing Charles Woodbridge lecture in 1959. I don't go along with everything Woodbridge says, but I remember his saying, I live to see the demise of Princeton Seminary. As one chair after another, after another, after another fell. Not by ugly, vicious kind of people, but gentle, gracious, brilliant, subtle minds. Until suddenly, I was surrounded and I was called the freak. I was weird. And it fell.
Apostasy has an insidious way of creeping into our ranks when we're not careful to guard the treasure of pure doctrine. And that's certainly one of the reasons we remain steadfastly committed to rightly dividing the word of truth. You're listening to Insight for Living, and another message in Chuck Swindoll's study of brief New Testament letters. It's a six-part series we're calling New Testament Postcards. To purchase the CDs or to download the complete sermons online, go to insightworld.org. It's remarkable to think that Jesus entrusted the gospel message and the integrity of doctrine to a ragtag collection of imperfect and flawed characters. We know them as the disciples. And yet God has always chosen to deliver His message through the voices and lives of those who follow Him. Well, in that spirit, we're pleased to offer a brand new and exclusive devotional from the Bible teaching of Chuck Swindoll. It's a spiral-bound book called Shaping the Modern Disciple. The book contains 15 brief chapters, highlighting each of the 12 disciples, plus James, Paul, and Matthias. When you give a donation of any amount to support Insight for Living, you're invited to request a copy. It comes with our thanks for your contribution. We believe that providing quality Bible study tools like this one is the perfect way to reinforce our partnership together. Thank you so much for standing with us by giving a donation. And again, request the devotional book called Shaping the Modern Disciple. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. Or online, go to insight.org. I'm Dave Spiker. Tomorrow, Chuck Swindoll continues our study in the book of Jude. Listen Wednesday to Insight for Living.
The preceding message, The Acts of the Apostates, was copyrighted in 1977, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2014 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.